Hi everyone, welcome to Brains, Black Holes, and Beyond, a collaboration podcast between Princeton Insights Newsletter and the Daily Princetonian. From the Prince, my name is Noelle. Our guest for today's episode on the topic of love is Dr. Talia Gigerenzer, a cultural anthropologist who focuses her studies on atmospheres, emotions, gender, urban space, poetics, and conviviality in contemporary South Asia. She also teaches an anthropology class dedicated to the study of love. Welcome to the show, Dr. Gigerenzer.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I'm aware that much of your research as an anthropologist focuses on South Asia and that your dissertation focused on the everyday lives of Muslim women in Delhi. With this global context in mind, could you briefly talk about any practices of romantic love, marriage, or familial love that you have observed abroad that may be surprising or different to what we might see here?
That's a great question. So my research focused on mostly Muslim women in Delhi, India, who came from low-income backgrounds. And I was looking at specifically how a lot of them were delaying marriage about 5 to 10 years later than their mother's generation had. Mm-hmm. And one of the things they did in this kind of prolonged window of time before marriage was have premarital romances, which was something that was rather new for their generation and still quite controversial because arranged marriage is still very much the norm. And one thing that was very interesting, and we can talk about this more as well if we go into technology more, but was that the rise of so-called WhatsApp romances, which in the context of my research meant people often meeting online through WhatsApp messages and texting each other, and that kind of turning into a relationship where people would meet in person. But the interesting thing is the ways in which these so-called, you might call them like Western forms of relationship, were still coexisting with more traditional ideas of family structures. So that was one of the interesting things that I found in my research.
That's super interesting. And thanks so much for bringing up the intergenerational differences and practices of romance, because I think that ties in really well to technology today. So using that as a transition, in what ways do you think technology and other digital mediums have transformed how we make connections with other people? And would you say that it has augmented the experience of love or perhaps taken away from the deeply personal experience that it should be?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question. I'll try to take a stab at it. If I think about my research context again, which I think I know better than like your generation's experience with technology and love, you see that technology isn't always the only factor that changed things, and that it like often, as I was saying, coexists with more traditional structures. So I found that a lot of the women that I was observing in Delhi were having these premarital romances that they were often keeping secret from their family, and they would be sharing a family phone between the whole family, and then they would text the boyfriend at night and then delete the messages the next day. But often they would, if they wanted the WhatsApp romance to turn into like a marriage, they would still ask their parents for permission. So, and often the WhatsApp courtship was a way for them to suss out, you know, if this person was a good match, if he had a good character, like all of these. It wasn't like necessarily linked with this hedonistic idea of romance where you're head over heels and it's just like a fling. So it was very much still embedded in familial structures.
So there's also kind of that practical side to using WhatsApp and
yes,
figuring it out.
Yeah, it was almost like a form of detective work for right. them. Like mm-hmm. they, and I think that actually applies to the Western context as well. Like people will use dating apps and social media to like really do background checks on the people, right? It's almost as if they know way too much information about them before they even meet them. I don't know if technology has resulted in less deep relationships. I would just caution us to not jump to the conclusion that it's one way or the other, I guess.
I'm glad you brought up the kind of reversed practice of in the West, we tend to have all of our personal information out there before you look at, you know, age, your height, things that you enjoy, like your hobbies. And then based on that, you can choose who might be a potential partner for you. So I wanted to direct our conversation to something that a lot of students participate here on campus. I'm not sure if you've heard of Data Match or Princeton Marriage
Guide. No, can you explain it to me?
So I personally have not used this before, but to my knowledge, it is a dating app in that you answer a series of questions in the form of a survey, and then that gets sent into this big database. And then based on all of the responses, you get matched with someone who's answered the question similarly to you. And so this can be for romantic love or just for finding friendships and stuff like that. So Princeton Marriage Pack would be specifically for Princeton, but Data Match, I believe, might be happening on other campuses as well. Mm-hmm. So what are your thoughts on these platforms that offer a chance at close relationships with complete strangers and potentially from a distance?
That's a very interesting example. It makes me wonder whether these dating apps privilege people who have a lot in common, so that it's almost as if you're privileging sameness versus often, you know, in a relationship, you'll have things that you disagree on or different interests. And I wonder if this would not leave room for difference. That's sort of my first thought. And I wonder also if the whole thing is becoming a very like quantified process. You're almost forced to fix your own identity as like, these are my interests, this is what I'm looking for, this is my five-year plan, in a way that maybe actually your interests might change in a month and you might want something completely different.
I also think, I don't know if this is a bit controversial, but because there's a set list of questions, you can also sort of anticipate what someone else might answer the question to and kind of tailor your own responses to what you expect others to like. So that's kind of my take on it as well, but I'm glad for all the insights that you've provided on what you think that might look like.
Yeah.
So I also wanted to ask that since love can be very personable and a vulnerable experience and something people often keep private, how would you as an anthropologist research the subject while respecting people's boundaries without sacrificing too much detail or personal knowledge?
That's a really good question. And that's something that we talked about a lot in my class on love that I taught in the fall, which is that in a lot of scholarship, not just anthropology, love has kind of been this blind spot that people either feel it's too hard to access to even study. I mean, it feels very invasive to study someone's romantic relationship. And also it feels like this kind of floofy thing sometimes that is not worthy of scientific study. But what I did in my fieldwork in India was my now husband, then partner, came with me a lot. And the women that I was working with, they would comment on our relationship a lot. And so I kind of used our relationship to see what they thought about love in general. So they would comment to me about our relationship was, what do you fight about? At first I was like, oh, this is very personal. But then I realized, okay, for them, what we fight about is telling them the substance of our relationship is, and like also kind of a test of our love for each other. And then they would tell me what they fought about with their husbands. So that's one of the ways you can sort of get at more personal views on love without being too invasive, I think, in this context.
I think that's one of the really great things about anthropology is that it allows you to bring your own personal narrative to your interlocutors. So I'm really glad that we got an anthropologist for this session. Bringing the conversation back to this intersection between technology and love. So assuming that this intersection has changed people's experiences and expectations of personal relationships, so thinking about the women in Delhi that you met with, as well as things like Data Match or Princeton Marriage Pact here, how does that impact methodology on the subject? And if people don't necessarily meet in person and much of the interaction takes place online, how would an anthropologist or ethnographer have to adapt to that?
So a lot of anthropologists who are studying these things will look at chat rooms or WhatsApp messages. I have some voice messages that people recorded to each other in the field that they allowed me to keep. But it's true. It's a very different field that it's very difficult to access because it's taking place on a different plane. But also people will talk about the WhatsApp messages that they've gotten, or they'll often in my field work, people would narrate like verbatim a series of messages or conversations that they had had on WhatsApp. So you can still kind of talk about it in real time.
Hey, that's super interesting. And glad to know that anthropologists are always, you know, keeping updated and adapting to the things that are changing around them. So now I wanted to just open up the conversation to any other comments that you might have on love, anything that you might teach during your love class.
Yeah, I think one of the big topics we talked about in my love class was, what does romantic love represent in different cultures? You know, in the West, I think, or in American culture, it has really represented this kind of total transcendence from everyday life for a long time. If you look at Hollywood movies, there are so few movies that are made that don't have a romantic plotline, and that's the central plotline, right? That's what you strive for. But there are many other cultures where romantic love is not the main goal. You know, it might be something that coexists with family or having sort of a familial harmonious structure around one is just as important as romantic love. So I think that's something important to keep in mind. Like, how do we think about the idea of love and what does it mean to us in different societies?
We always like to end our podcast with, if you have any advice for potential researchers out there on how to conduct ethnography or research in general.
The main bit of advice that I would give people who are doing any kind of fieldwork, so it doesn't have to be anthropological fieldwork, but anything where you have to go somewhere else and you're faced with challenges of being on the ground, just be open to things completely changing, your research questions completely turning on their head. Just be open to kind of going with the flow, and that's part of the excitement of it. Don't go into things with research questions that are too fixed, I guess. Be open to change.
I think that's really, really great advice. So thank you so much again for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
This episode of B-Cubed was written by Noelle Kim and me, hosted by Noelle Kim, audio engineered by Laura Sabrosa, and produced under the 148th Managing Board of the Prince. To learn more about the research that Dr. Gigerenzer does, visit the link in the description. For the Prince, my name is Lena Kim. Have a wonderful day.